This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the historic decision of former Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn to voluntarily relinquish power is something that's never happened in Ethiopian history before. It paved the way for the entree of the current Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy Ahmed, who has made a series of incredible political reforms.
That's Ruben Brigetti from George Washington University on the changes in Ethiopia this year that highlighted democratic development in Africa. Details coming up.
Also, Sudanese journalists and trade unions call for more anti-government protests today.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Some Rwandan Christians claim a law that prevents churches from making noise while worshiping is ruining their prayer rhythm in the festive season when they are traditionally thankful. Rwanda's government has ordered churches to reduce their volume or buy soundproofing to keep their sounds indoors. Failure to comply could mean getting shut down. Eugene Uimana has details from Kigali.
The sounds of drums, guitars, pianos, and whistles, accompanied by dances and jumping, are what the government says churches need to control for the sake of the common good. But some Christians believe they are told in the Bible that they should dance to celebrate and offer thanks and praise. Jean Vuti Ngoma thinks Christmas should be special. They should let us free, at least in these days. Some have passed away, but we are still alive, have so much thanksgiving, to dance the way we want, beating drums, as long as we are not betraying the country.
I can just carry on.
For other Rwandans who live near churches are backing the noise low. Shabana Kaitale says some people don't share the same belief or may be in their other business and get disturbed by the sounds of worship. It's their right to celebrate Christmas, but their gatherings have to conform to the general security. They can sing or pray silently without disturbing others. Johnson Businge, Attorney General and Minister of Justice, says the government has made itself clear that all activities have to respect others. People have different plans in the city. Some go out while others are sleeping. Some pray while others are in sports. So we are trying to define the indices of noise that make it pollution. But those who pray can easily know that they are disturbing people according to what they are doing. They have to abide by that regulation. A crackdown on poor infrastructure has closed some 8,000 churches this year, and the sound issue could raise the number. Critics say the government is infringing on freedom to worship, but it says it's just making sure churches operate safely and properly. Parliament passed another law in July requiring pastors to have a theological degree from an accredited school. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Madagascar's Electoral Commission says provincial results show that André Rajoelina has won the country's tightly contested runoff election for president. Rajoelina previously led the country after taking power in a 2009 coup. He won nearly 57% of the vote to defeat Marc Ravalomanana, who was ousted in the coup. The two candidates were both banned from running in the 2013 election as part of an agreement to end recurring crises that have rocked Madagascar since independence from France in 1960. The High Constitutional Court has 9 days to decide whether to confirm the results. Turnout was put at 48%, lower than the 54% in the first round ballot that eliminated other contenders. Madagascar is well known for its vanilla and precious redwood, yet is one of the world's poorest nations, according to World Bank data, with 76% of its people living in extreme poverty.
The Nigerian government is calling on states to enact laws to ban open defecation. The Minister of Water Resources has said it is regrettable that Nigeria has the second largest population after India defecating in the open. About 66 million Nigerians don't have access to toilets. The ministry has developed a roadmap and action plan to reposition the water and sanitation sectors. Key to that plan is ending open defecation by 2025 as part of the Sustainable Development Goals. Abukami Joseph is an environmentalist in Port Harcourt. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the problems caused by open defecation and the challenges to ending the practice in thousands of rural communities.
The health hazards associated with open defecations are numerous, but let me just highlight these ones: cholera, typhoid, and diarrhea. How do these happen? Typhoid is mostly gotten from drinking polluted waters. When we defecate openly, these feces simmer into underground waters. In riverine communities where open defecation is practiced, people mostly defecate into the rivers, into these water bodies. And these water bodies move, and eventually people drink water from sources they assume is clean sources. Meanwhile, these sources of water have migrated from sources where they have defecated into them, and this causes typhoid. Diarrhea, as we know, is continuous stooling. Diarrhea also is an impact of open defecation, because when you are pressed, you will be forced to defecate anywhere. But when you defecate anywhere, these parasites will still fester on these feces and will ingest it and will still lead to this diarrhea. So these are the issues.
The federal government has urged states to make bylaws to ban open defecation. Do you think it will end it?
I think it will go a long way. Even if in this part of the country, it is one thing to enact laws and it's one thing to implement. But before you implement anything, you must enact. So that is why the first step is to enact these laws to ban open defecation. Then leave it to the statutory authorities to enact these laws.
What should the states and local governments do to end the practice in the rural communities?
Thank you very much, because that is where the problem is. It is mostly in the rural communities, because in the metropolis there are a lot of public toilets, you can go to any fast food, but in the rural communities they don't have this luxury. Oftentimes they are challenged with the public toilet system, and the public toilet system in some communities, they have this challenge of culture where a man cannot share a toilet with a woman. Some have this culture of hierarchy. A junior cannot share a toilet with a senior. And when they do not have enough toilets, there's already a problem, because where there's a problem with disparity of gender, when a man is pressed and a woman is in the toilet, he will need to go and use an open place to defecate. Where there's a problem with hierarchy, if an elderly is pressed and a younger one is pressed, the elderly man will have the preference to use the toilet and the younger one will have to go to the open places to go and defecate. So these are the challenges. So that is where local government and state governments come in. Local government is the first connection to the general public before you get the state government. Local governments can build public sanitary systems for these communities. It is appalling to note that even UNICEF has stated that in 774 local governments in Nigeria, only 3 local governments have put in structures to palliate open defecation. It is beyond 1%. It is even beyond 0.05% of 774 local governments. So it is not rocket science. It is what local governments can do. They can go to 2, 3, 4 communities every year. By the time they do this in 5 years, almost all the communities in each local government will have access to a public toilet. Luckily, some states like Rivers State, Ondo State, Kaduna State have partnered with this NGO by releasing counterpart funding that will aid these NGOs to set up this system, but it is not enough. The local governments are the first tier that connects with the common man. They are the ones that have the sole responsibility to provide these amenities.
That was environmentalist Abubakame Joseph in Port Harcourt speaking with journalist Mike Mbonye.
Oh, Sudanese journalists and trade unions called for more anti-government protests today, and the head of the country's parliament agreed to question the interior minister about the use of force against peaceful demonstrators. The protesters are calling for President Omar al-Bashir to resign. Journalists and union members calling for new demonstrations, both inside the country and outside, want to draw attention to the government's use of violence against people protesting rising food and fuel prices. The government says 8 protesters have been killed in 2 weeks of demonstrations, while some opposition groups say more than 12 people have died. In a speech to graduating military cadets today, President Bashir blamed Western nations for causing the country's economic crisis. The United States lifted economic sanctions on Sudan in October, but the Sudanese pound has continued to lose much of its value against the dollar, prompting shortages of bread, fuel, and currency.
Our colleague Ayan Dieng Bior yesterday spoke with one of the protesters in Khartoum, Rudwan Dawed. He says they have no plans to back down on their demands.
Sudan is just in a point where it is like going through a total collapse of a state. So everything is just messed up, and the government has no idea about what is going on.
This isn't the first time that protesters in Sudan have taken to the streets. What's different about this time?
This one, the December uprising, it is the largest, and more cities and states are participating now. Sudanese people of all different backgrounds.
Why do you think that is?
From the north, south. Because what is going on is affecting everybody. Even the, you know, school students, they cannot go to school because they don't have money to buy food. People are living in just one meal a day. And, you know, the prices are skyrocketing. And we have shortage of gas and oil. And the banks, you know, they have no money. You can't even withdraw your own money from the bank. So it is just miserable, and the poverty level is just hitting every family. So it is all just messed up.
And how has the Sudanese government responded to the protesting?
They are responding, unfortunately, brutally. Just yesterday, we had one of the big protests. We were planning to deliver Sudanese, like we were trying to go to the presidential palace to ask the president to step down. We were faced by bullets. I have heard 2 people have lost their lives, but I'm not quite sure about it yet. But I have seen many people who were wounded, and many young peaceful protesters were arrested, beating, and it was just crazy. Khartoum was like a battlefield. It wasn't like it doesn't look like a city anymore now.
There's reports that the government used live ammunition. Have you seen any evidence of that?
Yes, I did. Yes, and I known people in a personal way. Yesterday, I talked to one of the young activist who had been hit in his leg. Luckily, he's still alive right now at the hospital. But he was hit by a real bullet. And this is just one symbol.
But President al-Bashir says he will introduce real reforms, and he says that the protesters are just introducing discord to the country. What's your reaction to that?
The president has no credibility. Nobody has zero respect for him because he has been lying over and over again. Even his own people, the village where he was born, they are turning against him right now because he knows he's been like a burden right now.
That was Rudwan Dawed, a political activist, speaking to Ayan Dieng Bior from Khartoum. Yeah.
Police in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo fired live ammunition and tear gas today to break up protesters angry about a decision to exclude them from Sunday's presidential election. Dozens of protesters attacked Ebola treatment centers in Beni and burned tires after the Electoral Commission said yesterday it was delaying voting until March in the cities of Beni, Butembo, and surrounding areas because of a deadly Ebola outbreak. About 2 dozen patients fled an Ebola isolation center, though most had not tested positive for the disease, and a few quickly returned. The areas where voting will be postponed are centers of opposition to outgoing President Joseph Kabila. Tariq Jasarvich is a spokesman with the World Health Organization. Just moments ago, he spoke with our colleague Paul Alexander about the attack on the Ebola center in Beni and said the unrest is worrying, but the workers are staying put to tackle the disease.
Today there were manifestations in town of Beni, one of the epicenters of Ebola outbreak in North Kivu, in Democratic Republic of the Congo. These demonstrations resulted in disruption in Ebola response work by WHO and other medical teams on the ground, and also resulted in attacks on several buildings inside the city. So this really shows how difficult the context is in which we are operating and how much it is important for us to have adequate environments to be able to provide Ebola response activities to the population.
Any of your staff injured in all of this?
No, we had no WHO injured staff, and we know that Ebola responders were not targeted in these demonstrations. In fact, majority of population and of civil society as well support Ebola response activities. In fact, there was a call by the civil society to let Ebola responders do their job. What happened today really is that there were attacks on government buildings, and it happened that one of those were Ebola transit center that was basically a place where people who were suspected Ebola cases were staying, and we are now assessing really the status of these people and where they are.
And how many of them were there, and you're trying to track them down, correct?
According to the Ministry of Health, majority of people who left the center were already tested negative for Ebola, and few of them were awaiting for the result. So we are not speaking about positive Ebola cases running around in the community, but again, it is a serious situation, and the Ministry of Health, supported by WHO and other partners, are trying to get in touch with these people and continue to work in order really to have everyone who may have been exposed to get tested and eventually, if needed, to be treated.
Now, in the past, when your operations have been disrupted, you have ended up having a spike in cases several days or to a week later. Do you think that that is likely or possible to happen again this time?
Well, you are absolutely right. We know that if we interrupt our activities, if we are not able to go to community, if we are not able to trace all those people who may have been exposed to the virus, if we are not able to vaccinate those who are eligible for vaccination, if people who are positive of Ebola do not go to treatment center to get treated, obviously we will see increase in number of cases. However, we need really to stress that today we were not able to work only in Beni. In other places, even in Butembo, that has seen some protests yesterday, we were able to continue our work and investigate alerts and test people who were suspected to have contracted the virus. So again, there is an issue of security. This is what we have been saying from the beginning of this outbreak. Every time there is a security incident, every time our teams are not able to go where they need to go, whether it's for a full day or just a couple of hours, it does slow down the response, and this is why we are still combating this Ebola outbreak 5 months after it started.
Considering the volatility of the election campaign, Does this raise concerns about the safety of staff moving forward? Are there any thoughts of pulling out at least some staff?
We are concerned about the safety and security of our own staff, but also of all responders in this outbreak. However, for the time being, we are staying. We are not considering to pull out, but we are monitoring the situation, and obviously we need to have contingency plans for different scenarios.
WHO's Tariq Jasarvic speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander.
2018 sitting leaders relinquished power in South Africa and Ethiopia. Zimbabwe elected a new leader after 37 years of rule by former President Robert Mugabe. Peaceful power transitions were also seen in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Mali. But while many find those trends encouraging, the opposite is also true in countries where some of the world's longest-serving leaders continue to hold power. VOA correspondent Mariamo Giallo reports on the overall trends that are sparking both hope and worry.
Ethiopia saw unprecedented political change in 2018, says Ruben Brigidy, former U.S. ambassador to the African Union.
The historic decision of former Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn to voluntarily relinquish power is something that's never happened in Ethiopian history before. It paved the way for the entree of the current Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy Ahmed, who has made a series of incredible political reforms, the release of political prisoners, to leading the effort to appoint the first female president in Ethiopia's history.
The second most populous country in Africa also made peace with its neighbor Eritrea after 20 years of hostility. But nearly 1 million people have been displaced in southern Ethiopia since clashes erupted there in April, according to UN agencies. In Zimbabwe, the forced resignation of President Robert Mugabe in late 2017 paved the way for elections this year. Ken Opalo, assistant professor of African politics at Georgetown University.
It wasn't democratic, but it was a transition. And I think any transition is better than no transition, especially if it's done constitutionally, which, you know, ZANU-PF jumped through a lot of hoops to make it look like it was a democratic transition.
The elections were won by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, a longtime ally of Mugabe, making some wonder if this was a real transition from the old guard.
I think, you know, as we're seeing in Mozambique and Angola, any transition is good because the new set of rulers typically want to, you know, be their own men and women. And so they'll implement reforms like you're seeing in Angola that may not always go well with the previous regime.
While trends for democracy are encouraging, countries like Congo-Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea, Cameroon, Sudan, and Uganda are home to some of the longest-serving presidents in Africa. In the case of Equatorial Guinea's president, Theodoro Obiang-Nguema Mbasogo, 2019 will mark his 40th year in power. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.